mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott.
I grew up in the Clearwater area of Florida. I went to college in Jacksonville at University of North Florida. I went for a degree in advertising. I also minored in photography. I got involved, well, I figure you're going to ask later on about what got me involved in the drones and everything.
Clay Folden is a drone operator. He doesn't work for the Department of Defense or Homeland Security. As far as we know, he's never killed an enemy combatant or spied on anybody. Clay is a photographer, and he's one of a growing number of amateur pilots around the world who are flying unmanned aerial vehicles, or as we usually call them, drones.
One day I get a phone call from my dad. He was talking with my uncle for a little bit. My uncle was viewing this footage of boats and of real estate properties from just impossibly low vantage points and angles and stuff. And he was really interested on how they were doing that because it didn't look like it was actually coming off of a helicopter. It was getting these impossibly close and low spots. So he kind of brought my attention to drone cinematography.
Drones come in all shapes and sizes, and the one that Clay eventually bought is nothing like those steel-gray Reapers and Predators and Global Hawks that we see in the news, multi-million-dollar war machines equipped with missiles and wingspans in excess of 116 feet. Clay's humble drone is called a Phantom and is made by a Chinese company called DJI that specializes in small commercial unmanned aerial vehicles. More specifically, his is what's called a quadricopter. It flies using four small propellers, weighs less than 2.5 pounds, and isn't much bigger than a shoebox. You can go online right now and order your own for a few $100 from a dealer or a hobby shop. Give me sort of a picture of that first time you opened your Phantom and took it out on a test run. How'd it go?
First time I took it out, man, I'm looking at the box and I'm just like, what the hell have I gotten myself into? So the first one, man, there was barely a manual, if you could call that thing a manual. And it was in just awful English. I went out to one of the parks around where I live, and I took it up in the air. And being that investment to where I didn't have much money at the time, and this was a total Hail Mary.
Like, if you crash this thing, it's going to be awful. You're going to be ruined.
Oh, I know. And I just look at it. I'm like, I just see a price tag flying around. I don't see a quad. I just see how much money I have just flying around in the sky that could literally go anywhere. And, you know, I had my first flight. Everything happened without incident. And I noticed how bad I was actually shaking. But yeah, I remember that. And I used to play quite a bit of Xbox and N64 and a lot of video games. So I think that really helped with the eye-hand coordination. I picked it up pretty quick after that, so.
Oh, that's good. So we in the video game generation are going to be the master drone users.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But Clay's drone isn't just an expensive toy. It's a tool. Just as important to him as a photographer as his tripod, his laptop, his photo editing software. Even more important, because Clay's drone is what sets him apart from the competition. Last year, Clay produced a video of aerial vacation footage shot entirely by drone. Breathtaking vistas of cities, national parks, deserts, oceans. Some of the shots start about knee-high, impossibly close, as Clay's uncle would put it, and then climb hundreds of feet into the air in a matter of seconds. There's something about them that seems unreal, and yet they are unmistakably authentic when compared to the CGI that we're used to seeing in the movies nowadays. When the video got picked up by the Huffington Post, it went viral, and soon after, Clay's phone started ringing with job opportunities. There's just one problem. If you're going to go drone, you've got to follow the rules.
Some of the FAA regulations are there's a 300-foot ceiling, so you can't fly above 300 feet. That's public airspace, and you could endanger people. You can't fly within proximity to airports, which that's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, that sounds sensible.
Yeah, you don't want that up in the air when there's a lot of air traffic. You cannot operate these commercially either, which is what really gets a lot of flack. Not so much from the hobbyists, but from the people that all around the country that are trying to start up their own aerial production companies.
Well, so what do you mean you can't use it for commercial reasons? Like you can't use it on a film set?
You could use it on the film set, but you cannot get compensated for it.
So are you telling me that the videos that you've done, which are really cool and have gone viral, you know, got picked up by the Huffington Post and other places, you haven't gotten paid for those?
The videos that I have online, I have not been paid for. Which is very unfortunate. Just very unfortunate because, you know, spent a lot of time learning how to do this and really understanding the systems and learning how to fly, and there's no real reimbursement for that available yet.
Do you think it's going to pay off?
I mean, it's a matter of time until the regulations do come around. And as far as exposure is concerned for me, it has paid off. You know, if it wasn't for the quad, I'd still be trying to yell in a room full of people shouting out here as far as trying to get jobs and stand above the crowd was concerned.
After talking to Clay, I'm convinced that drones are going to play a huge role in the future of photography. 100% convinced. We're going to see drone footage in commercials. We're going to see them in Hollywood films. We're probably even going to see them at weddings. And once those floodgates open, there is no going back. The possibilities are way too alluring. And a little scary, but that's all part of the package.
Prior to drones, you would have to hire a pilot with a helicopter and then hire a film crew to go on that actual helicopter. And the airport fees, pilot fees, crew fees, gas, and all of that. So, you know, the industry is definitely headed this way as far as cinematography is concerned because it's a much more cost-efficient method. And you have actually a lot more freedom of the location that you can choose for these as well.
Big thanks to Clay Folden, freelance photographer there, for sharing his story with us. You can check out his awesome drone footage at wordofmouthradio.org. And I'm here to tell you that photography is just the very tip of the iceberg. Today on Word of Mouth, it's the Drone Show. We're going to talk about how drones might be used to revolutionize agriculture, journalism, and sports coverage, or on the other hand, used by the paparazzi to spy on celebrities. We're going to have more on the developing legal status of small UAV operators and where the U.S. stands in relation to the rest of the world when it comes to drone regulation. And of course, you can't talk about drones without talking about drone strikes. So when we come back, the debate over President Obama's use of drones overseas. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Today, we're exploring the world of drones. From package delivery to precision agriculture, unmanned aerial vehicles can serve a variety of purposes. But before we venture further into the commercial use of drone technology, we have to address its most controversial role, military strikes. For this, we look to the NPR debate series Intelligence Squared, U.S. Last October, it staged a debate on the motion, "The U.S. drone program is fatally flawed," where two teams argued for and against the motion. Let's start with the opening statements of General Norton Schwartz, former chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force. He argues in favor of U.S. drone policy.
What I want to do tonight, and I submit, ladies and gentlemen, that the employment of U.S. strike-capable systems is a viable and a rational response to a vexing battlefield problem, one that must be calibrated, used with care, synced with policy, but nonetheless, one that allows us to pursue our objectives in a fashion that minimizes loss of life for friendly forces and maximizes opportunity to avoid needless casualties of friendlies, in other words, collateral damage. Simply, remotely piloted aircraft or drones permit more considered and more accurate, more proportionate application of lethal force than any other comparable weapon system. Because they can spend longer time over the target than equivalent manned aircraft, they give their operators the time to maximize the certainty that they are engaging the right enemy combatants and that they have the time and the means to confirm the presence of non-combatants in the presence of the intended target. Thoughtful observers like our partners tonight have mentioned a number of criticisms. Let me talk quickly about a couple of them. One is the absence of physical risk to the operator encourages our political leadership to use remote systems more often than they would if they had to put American troops in harm's way. I would counter by asking whether those who use this argument would prefer for the American military to absorb casualties just for the purpose of making war less numbing to the political leadership. In addition, at the tactical level, soldiers and airmen under fire on the ground, I think you would agree, Cale, are far more likely to shoot back at the sources of fire aimed against them with greater danger to non-combatants than are remote operators whose safety and lives are not at immediate risk. There's also a concern that non-state or state actors will use these technologies against us in a more crude and indiscriminate fashion than do we, and well, they might. But the reality is that this technology is proliferating. And not because we chose to use it. It is a fact of technology advancing, and our lead was and remains significant.
I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott, and today we're talking about drones. We continue our look into U.S. drone policy with the NPR debate series Intelligence Squared U.S. and the opening statements of Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He argues against U.S. drone policy.
The first thing I think to make clear is that, unfortunately, drones, it's a weapon, it's a tool, it's a tactic, has almost become a strategy in itself. And this is how foreign governments and countries where drones are being used see it. So, in fact, drones are undermining U.S. foreign policy. They become the only symbol of foreign policy which people abroad remember when those countries in particular are targeted. Some of the countries, like Yemen, like Pakistan, are in fact allies of the United States. And drones are being used against allies. Naturally, that is infuriating the population even more. Secondly, how badly have drones affected the counterterrorism strategy, the much more sophisticated strategy that has emerged from the U.S. in the last few years? Again, here we see the counterterrorism strategy being undermined completely by drones because, you know, the people are very scared of them. And they do take out civilian targets just as much as they take out Al-Qaeda. The other question, which I think has to be agitating the minds of many Americans, is how legal is this? How legal is it to bomb and kill individuals in another country with which you are not at war? Nobody is informed as to why and how these people are being killed. The lack of transparency is not helped by the fact that the CIA has been mostly involved in using drones, especially in Pakistan. Now, what all this is leading to is an enormous buildup of hatred for the United States. And that is not just affecting people in the target countries, but people all over the Muslim world in particular. Now, what should also be worrying is the precedent that is being set. First of all, what happens if a European country or Russia or a so-called ally of the United States uses drones? What is the U.S. strategy going to be? Are you going to tell that country to behave itself and say, no, only we have the right to kill people in other countries. You don't have that right. Even more dangerous, what happens when an enemy of the United States uses drones? What happens if North Korea tomorrow uses drones to kill South Koreans? What happens if the Syrians or any of the problematic regimes start using drones? What will be the U.S. policy then? Are you going to go and bomb those countries? There's a complete vacuum here. There's no thought being given to this. But this could happen tomorrow. I think the other thing I must answer the issue of civilian casualties. There is, for example, a drone strategy now where drones fire what are called signature strikes. That is, if a bunch of militants are seen, or one or two militants are seen in a group of civilians, drones are used, can be used to kill that militant. But of course, they kill everybody else in the truck too. Women, children, men, civilians. Lastly, I think we have to understand how drones have become a recruiting poster for Al-Qaeda and for global jihad. Even local groups, local militant groups in countries which had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, nothing to do with global jihad, if they have been droned, they become global jihadists. They want to strike back at America.
Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid laying out his argument against America's drone policy there. You can find a link to the whole debate at wordofmouthradio.org. With personal drones like quadricopters becoming cheaper and easier to buy, the debate over how to regulate them is heating up. Here in New Hampshire, a bill aimed at protecting privacy was drafted in the House late last year that would have put heavy restrictions on drone use. However, during public hearings for the bill, many organizations took issue with the proposed law's broad language, among them a vocal group of model airplane enthusiasts. We were interested in learning more about these old-school drone flyers, so we sent producer Zach Nugent to a hobby shop in Windham to speak with members of a local RC club, the New Hampshire Flying Tigers.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm Bill.
I'm Zach.
Hi, Zach.
Nice to meet you.
My name's Bill Horton. I own this the hobby shop. It's called ABC RC and Hobbies, and we sell all kinds of RC products.
Let me get it so I can ring it up.
A kid that I hung out with and myself saw somebody that had a model airplane that flew, and it fascinated us, and we sort of got together, and we had very little parental help. We figured everything out ourselves. I crashed several planes trying to teach myself, and then probably about 12 years ago, I wanted to go back in and learn to fly, so I joined a club and learned to fly.
Crashes are common. My name is Paul Lockwood. I live in Londonderry. When I was learning, in fact, my nickname was Lucky because I managed to crash three planes within about a three-week period while learning to fly.
The speed on that thing is almost 200 miles
an
hour.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
The flip answer for why I got into the hobby is probably that as I considered retirement, my wife said I better find a hobby or she'll kill me. Our club has members literally ranging in age from 11 to close to 90.
There with you. One watching this away and one watching this away. Because
and a young pilot with good eyes.
At that speed, you can't judge where that thing is at. I can't. I mean, I'm 80 years old. I can't judge where I'm at.
My name is Bob Kilman. I live in Nashua. I started in this hobby in 1957. I've always, even as a really, really young kid, I've always loved aviation. I've been in it ever since. I like everything about the hobby. I like flying. I like building. I like the friendship that we have. I like helping people. I just like everything about it.
This is the latest rage, the quadcopters. And this is a small one. It comes with a camera.
Oh, wow, it's really small.
Controller, it's all self-contained, ready to fly.
And it comes with a camera, you said?
Yeah. See this little camera down there?
Oh, yeah.
My name's David Johnson. I'm from Methuen, Mass. I'm a member of the Hampshire Flying Tigers up in Derry. We used to fly, a few of us used to fly combat, RC combat. We use these planes called Gremlins. They're basically almost like a flying wing. And you put a ribbon on it. You put a 15-foot string and a 15-foot ribbon. Then you go up there and you try to cut the ribbons. You do it by points. You know, you get a point for a cut. But also, the person gets the point if two planes collide and they're both crashing. You try to keep yours up in the air because the last one to crash actually gets the point. So these things could be tumbling out of the air and these guys are still trying to control them and keep them up.
You can fly this right over somebody's house. That's a quad.
Our flying is having fun together. I've gone to the field some days and not even flown. I just sit up there and visit and enjoy the outdoors.
Sounds nice. I might have to come watch.
Yeah, you ought to come up to the field sometime. You're always welcome. Everybody's welcome. Just come up.
Yeah.
That piece was produced by Zach Nugent. Thanks to Paul Lockwood, Bob Kilman, Bill Horton, and David Johnson there, members of the New Hampshire Flying Tigers RC Club. And we continue our drone show with some breaking news from the UAV front. This week, TechCrunch reported that Mark Zuckerberg may be dipping his toe into the drone waters. Yes, apparently Facebook is in talks with Titan Aerospace, an aircraft design company that recently created the Solera 60, a solar-powered drone that can reach suborbital heights and fly for up to 5 years without landing, basically a much cheaper version of a satellite. So why is Facebook interested in spending $60 million to acquire Titan Aerospace? Well, TechCrunch reports that the drones would be used to provide internet access across the world in places where building ground infrastructure would be way too expensive. Now that sounds like the ultimate social network. Stay with us. Our drone show continues with more on how UAVs can be used for journalism. That's when Word of Mouth continues. Shoot the children.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. When you hear the word drone, what do you picture? Missile strikes and secret surveillance photos? The blunt nose of a 27-foot MQ-1 Predator? Or do you picture a 2.5-pound quadricopter built in someone's basement from parts bought at the local hobby shop? Military drone strikes aside, small unmanned aerial vehicles are poised to change the way we do business, scientific research, and more, from wildlife conservation to home delivery systems like Amazon's Prime Air initiative. Joining me to discuss the big implications of modestly sized drones is Kashmir Hill, senior online editor at Forbes, where she covers the intersection between privacy, technology, and the law. Hi, Kashmir.
Hi, Taylor.
Also with us is Matt Waite, professor of journalism at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and founder of the Drone Journalism Lab. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, whether we're talking about military applications or small commercial innovations, a lot of people sort of recoil, I suppose, when they hear the word drone. Do you think there's a danger in maybe lumping them all together?
There is. I have a little $30 quad here sitting on my desk. It's as big as the palm of my hand. To a lot of people, that's a drone, even though you can't fly it autonomously. It just flies around, and it's a fun little toy, and I give them to students who are first learning how to fly these things because they can't break it and they can't hurt themselves with it. So if that $30 toy and a $130 million global hawk are both drones, then I don't think the word has a lot of meaning anymore. The problem is it's a single syllable, and it's easy, and it rolls off the tongue a lot easier than unmanned aerial vehicle or unmanned aerial system or remotely piloted aircraft system is my current favorite.
Okay, so Kashmir, why don't we talk a little bit about where the law currently stands in the U.S. Regarding drones. What's allowed? Do you know how many are out there, that sort of thing?
I'm not sure how many are out there right now, but use is limited to essentially government use. Law enforcement can get a license to use a drone for surveillance purposes. They have been used that way in the U.S. so far, but private use isn't allowed yet. The FAA is supposed to come out with rules that will allow private entities to use them so that Google can send out street view drones and start, you know, mapping the U.S. But technically, they're not supposed to be flown for commercial uses yet. So there is at least one pilot who's trying to challenge that and is saying that the FAA shouldn't be allowed to ban commercial use of drones.
Well, and you're talking about commercial use, but there are exceptions for, say, hobbyists. People who fly remote control airplanes are using a type of drone.
Right. So the drone purists would hate if you called a remote, you know, piloted aircraft basically a hobby plane, a drone. But yeah, as long as you keep it under 400 feet and you're not getting paid to fly it, you can be using these like small kind of drone-like things.
Okay, so there are a lot of legal matters to consider before drones become commercially viable, whether or not that's for Amazon's delivery service or anybody else who wants to try and use them for business purposes. For example, I suppose liability in case a drone were to, say, fall out of the sky and cause damage or hurt someone. So what are some of those big questions being addressed right now by the FAA and in general?
Well, the FAA is supposed to be making a kind of safety determination, you know, and they say that's why it's taking so long for them to make this decision about drones. Because if Amazon starts you know, delivering packages with drones. We want to know that the drones aren't going to, you know, run into a power line or land on somebody's cat. But then there are a lot of privacy and surveillance groups who say, well, we want you to be making decisions about the privacy implications of drones as well. Should there be kind of restrictions on what drones are allowed to film, where they can go?
Right. Who's airspace? You know, can my neighbor's drone sort of fly over into my own backyard, and is that my space or is that allowed?
So that actually already happened to a friend of mine in Washington, D.C. A drone crash landed in her backyard, and it had a camera on it, and she and her roommate were really freaked out by it, and they put like a cloth over the camera. But before they did that, they wrote on a piece of paper their phone number and held it in front of the camera, and they soon got a call, and the person said, oh, you know, did you catch my lost drone? So these things are already happening, and that's just with hobbyists flying them.
Vision of the future to come, maybe. Between the two of you, you've both reported on many emerging uses or proposed uses for drones, and I'd love to hear some of maybe the most amazing examples you've heard about. Matt, you first. Where have you been surprised to see the possible applications of drones?
Well, I live in an agricultural state, so hearing about a lot of the uses that are emerging around agriculture, I mean, the agricultural uses, honestly, will probably dwarf most of the other uses, including law enforcement. Farmers all across the country will soon have these and will be able to monitor their crops, you know, by the hour, by the minute. Around here, we've talked about using them to specifically identify weed species that are bad for crops, and being able to go out and apply only the amount of weed killer that would be required to kill that weed, which would vastly reduce the amount of chemicals in fields and honestly the cost. My other kind of favorite example is golf courses.
Hmm.
If you've ever played golf on a day that they watered the course, there are parts of it that are swampy. Well, if a golf course owner had a way to monitor where needed to be watered and where didn't, they'd be able to vastly reduce the amount of water that is put on a golf course, increase the golf course's environmental sustainability, and also free up that water to, you know, grow food or quench your thirst.
Kashmir, how about you? Favorite drone story thus far?
I mean, I tend to be interested in privacy and surveillance issues, so those are my favorite drone stories. There's a drone that was used in Dallas by an environmental activist who flew over a kind of private area around a meatpacking factory and discovered that all this blood was being basically sent into the river there, and he took pictures with a drone and then, you know, sent those in to regulators to check out. I've heard of paparazzi already starting to use drones more outside of the U.S. than in the U.S. You know, there was a celebrity wedding happening in a remote area, and photographers were not allowed there and couldn't get access, but they were able to fly drones, you know, on the cliff face and take photos.
I'm talking about small unmanned aerial vehicles or drones with Kashmir Hill, senior online editor at Forbes, and Matt Waite, founder of the Drone Journalism Lab. Matt, you founded the Drone Journalism Lab to research how drones could be used for reporting purposes. We just heard one side of that, the paparazzi, maybe a little creepy there, but what other uses do you think drones could have for journalism?
Well, the original idea that I had came at a digital mapping conference, and it was a company was selling a device that was billed as a fully autonomous aerial mapping platform, where it had a camera in the bottom of it, and it was a fixed-wing aircraft, and you plugged in a flight plan that included you just drawing a little rectangle around a large area that you wanted photographed, tell it where you wanted it to take off from and where you wanted it to land, and off it would go, and it would fly back and forth and back and forth and back and forth across that area, taking pictures the whole time. The thing would land, you'd pull the memory card out of the camera, plug it into this tablet computer that they sold you, and it would stitch all those images together into a composite high-resolution image of the ground. And I thought of every hurricane and tornado and flood and wildfire that I'd ever covered as a reporter. I'm like, this is it. We could do really highly accurate damage assessment stories in natural disasters in a matter of hours. there's a number of different things that you can do with these things that don't involve stalking celebrities and violating people's privacy that I think would be really useful in terms of the public's understanding of things going on around them.
What's interesting about this to me is that it reveals that there is really a great power in the drone, like many other technologies, to be used or abused depending on who's behind the controls. If in 2015 the FAA relaxes restrictions on commercial use of drones, do we know whether or not they're going to be able to have the manpower or ability to, say, crack down on unauthorized use or prosecute people who are using drones for illicit purposes?
The truth is we don't know what the FAA is going to do at this point. We've picked up little dribs and drabs of hints here and there that it's highly likely that there's going to be some kind of licensing setup that in order to fly commercially, you will need to have some level of pilot training. That may be FAA ground school. That may be something more significant than that. You will almost certainly have to take a test. You'll almost certainly have to get a license. They've said you may have to submit to a background check. Mm. You will almost certainly have to provide safety data. So if something crashes, they need the data from that to find out why and what could have happened. They can look into it. You'll have to do some self-reporting. There's talk in a lot of circles about flight plan approval, of having to file flight plans and having them approve that, although that from a manpower standpoint, that's almost completely unworkable. For me, as a journalist, I get worried about talk of things like flight plan approval and prior approval of flights because it opens up an avenue for prior restraint cases, where if the government doesn't like the kind of reporting that I want to do with a UAV, they can deny me a permit to go fly that day, and that has First Amendment implications that I'm not sure the FAA has thought through completely or is thinking about.
So we've been talking here mostly about the legality of flying drones in the U.S. What's the status of flying drones outside of the country? Matt, what do you think?
You can essentially group most countries in the world into one of three groups. There's the U.S. where we stand alone in the no, you can't do it, nobody, no, none. Countries that do have rules generally are pretty restrictive, and they have a pretty significant regulatory scheme in place, but commercial operation is possible. You can fly commercially in Canada. You can fly commercially in the UK. In Australia, ESPN and Fox Sports use UAVs to cover things like cricket matches or Australian rules football games because commercial operations are allowed there.
And then actually, I think I saw drones being used in Sochi, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, actually, you very much did, and they were being used there. The kind of third group of countries in the world is they haven't even begun to consider this, and so there's no rules at all. So it varies by country to country, and there are countries that are significantly further down the road on this than the U.S.
Kashmir, last question to you. I know that new technology has a way of making waves. We've heard about 3D printers being used to make guns or whether or not self-driving cars are vulnerable to hacking. And I'm wondering if, as somebody who covers technology on a regular basis, in the end, do you think that advancing tech tends to win out over hesitations over possible misuse or mistrust?
Yeah, I mean, I think whenever we're talking about new technologies, we always go to the extreme cases. And that's just how we like to think about these things. It's how advocates and people debating the issues like to think about things. But it does feel like technology keeps pushing forward, and it is hard to hold back. And technology often moves forward faster than the law. The only time I've really seen technology kind of effectively held back is around facial recognition. And, you know, Google has said that they have the power to do kind of universal facial recognition at this point, but they're holding it back because they think it's creepy. And I think it's very rare that actually happens.
Kashmir Hill is senior online editor at Forbes, where she covers privacy and technology. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
And Matt Waite, professor of journalism at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and founder of the Drone Journalism Lab. Thank you, too.
Happy to do it.
Word of mouth! This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Today, we've been tackling the upside of drones, not as weapons or surveillance tools, which certainly they are, but as gadgets that could revolutionize journalism, photography, and more. We're going to finish up today with a critical look at an entirely different kind of drone, one that doesn't spy or even fly, but just goes on and on and on. That was a snippet from A Cage of Stars, a nearly 30-minute piece of music by minimalist composer Phil Niblock. Now, you'd think that drone music, practically the antithesis of pop, would have a very narrow audience. But drone has surprisingly deep roots in traditional music, and in recent years it's splintered into a number of niche subgenres. Techno drone, drone rock, and even drone folk, like this song by British experimentalist Alexander Tucker. Despite its potential to be, yes, incredibly annoying, drone might just have deceivingly profound implications, offering listeners a window into the nature of the universe itself. Okay, that's a pretty tall order, so here to help convince us is Marcus Boone. He's an English professor at York University in Toronto. He's written about drone for Wired and Boing Boing. Marcus, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
So, Marcus, before we dive in, I want to just clarify that we're not talking about music made by actual drones. We're talking about music that has something called a drone, which, as you might expect, sort of drones on and on and on. So why don't you first offer your simpler definition of what exactly a drone is?
Well, I think a drone is basically a piece of music in which any combination of tones or sounds is sustained over a period of time. Could be 30 seconds or it could be days. Sometimes it's a drone is really a part of a pop song, or it might be a musical object in itself. So the entirety of the composition just consists of a sustained set of tones.
Now, I have to admit, when I first read about drone, it struck me as being a pretty avant-garde genre, but you've identified drone's influence in a number of unusually, I guess, mainstream places. So I just want to play a few song clips and have you explain what we're listening to. First, the song Heroin. People will recognize this one. This is by The Velvet Underground.
Gonna try to nullify my life, 'cause when the blood begins to flow and it shoots up the dropper's neck, when I'm closing in on death.
Now, even though this is a rock song, you can really sort of hear that, what is it, a cello that's droning on, sort of that one continuous note?
Yeah, that's right. That's John Cale playing the cello. And, you know, the Velvet Underground really introduced drones to, I don't know, popular music maybe, or certainly to rock and roll. And John Cale, who was classically trained, had performed with Lamont Young, who's the guy that arguably introduced or reintroduced drones to classical music. So Cale was part of his ensemble in the early 60s. And when he became part of the Velvet Underground with Lou Reed, he brought that droning technique that he'd learned from Lamont Young and colleagues to the Velvets. And that's really how drones entered rock music.
Okay, I want to reach even further back to the blues artist Fred McDowell. Now, this is a song called Shake 'Em On Down from the Alan Lomax recordings. Now, a very different kind of drone there, kind of a melancholy, repetitive drone. How do you think this is different than what the Velvet Underground was doing?
One of the differences, and there are people, like I've had arguments with this with people at The Wire, for example, who would say that that is not a drone because the tones are not actually sustained. It's more that a particular chord is strummed very rapidly.
Right, but you can definitely hear that sort of sound.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I think there is a kind of trace of drone in the blues, and whether that comes through spirituals and through, I don't know, church music in different ways, where of course the church organ would have provided a kind of drone sound. You know, West African blues music has its basis in Arabic maqam, and you know, there are also drone-like sounds in maqam too.
What would you say is the sonic attraction of a drone? You know, what are musicians trying to evoke? And especially that spiritual tradition, what is that aimed at bringing out in a listener?
Yeah, it's a very tricky question because, of course, there's many different uses for that sound. And in general, I mean, let's begin with drones being annoying. Why are drones annoying to a lot of people? They're annoying because they don't change. And what people want from music is a feeling of change and transformation. They want to be amused in some way. A drone repeats something. What's interesting about listening to a drone when it's composed with intelligence and grace and beauty, if you like, is that you're forced to focus on the pitch combinations. And as you kind of relax your desire for change, something else opens up. And sometimes that's something spiritual. You know, certainly in church music, the drone is meant to evoke a religious feeling, a feeling of awe, a feeling of transcendence of the self. But then if you think about, I don't know, doom metal or the use of drones in film soundtracks where a certain feeling of menace or fear is evoked, I guess that would be an example of a situation where the self is not transcended and there's a kind of fear of loss of the self that's evoked instead.
So you talked about well-composed drone music, but drone reminds me a little bit of modern art. You know, it's not surprising when someone goes to see a painting and they see a square or a dot on a big blank canvas and they think, well, I could do that. And, you know, similarly, a lot of non-musicians might listen to drone and think, well, of course, anybody can hook up a bunch of pedals and record feedback for 30 minutes. How do you think how drone is made plays into whether or not people appreciate it?
Well, it depends what we're talking about. For example, I think there's a drone-like quality to certain kinds of jug bands. And increasingly, I think what you're seeing in sort of, I don't know, bohemian hipster circles are groups of people who get together and play drone rock because there are a set of techniques that are actually very easily shared by people. And the results are kind of powerful. There's a kind of democratization of music that can happen with drones where lots of people could participate in making drones.
Kind of like a drum circle.
Yeah, like a drum circle or, I don't know, quilting bee with the buzzing bees.
Right.
You know, it can be seen as a kind of collective activity.
You write about a very striking example of drones in the real world. It's about a discovery that NASA made, I think, in the 90s. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Basically, the universe, according to physics, is composed of waves or vibrations. That's one way of describing what the universe is. And that the universe is traversed by enormous, effectively sound waves. And they're way too deep for us to actually hear. But when the audible drones that one might listen to at a concert are said to evoke a religious feeling, one way of thinking about them is that the sound that you can hear is meant to evoke a much broader sense of a universe of vibration that is there but is inaudible, that still somehow we're a part of.
Marcus Boone is a professor of English at York University in Toronto, Canada, and he's written about drone music for Boing Boing and Wired. Marcus, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Thanks for listening today. Don't forget to check out our online feature, The Many Genres of Drone, and read about the black hole that's been emitting an ultra-deep drone for some 2.5 billion years. All of that's at wordofmouthradio.org, where you can also listen back to the full show if you missed anything. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 for more stories told best by word of mouth.